Hi, this is John Sellers, the author of Perfect From Now On, How Indie Rock Saved My Life. You're listening to Scott on Insomnia Radio San Francisco. It rules.
Thunderhawk, Computer Science Department of Justice Alliance versus Robots.
The Computer Science Department of Justice Alliance. Downloaded viruses came from the future, with millions of papers deciphering codes. All I see are robots when I sleep.
From the noise pop capital of the world, welcome to Insomnia Radio San Francisco. And now here is your host, Scott Tinetti.
Hi there, everyone. Welcome to yet again a special edition of Insomnia Radio San Francisco. This one is featuring an interview with John Sellers, the author of Perfect From Now On, How Indie Rock Saved My Life. And I had the unique and fantastic fortune to sit down with John for a couple of hours the other night over some beers in a pub in San Francisco to discuss his book, to discuss indie music, and to discuss our mutual love of Guided by Voices. And for the music in this episode, I have selected five bands with five tracks, each of which probably could have been written by Robert Pollard, the genius behind Guided by Voices. They sound a lot like them. I don't know that they're trying to imitate them, but for whatever reason, when I first heard these songs, I immediately thought of Guided by Voices, otherwise known as GBV, which you will hear a lot in this episode. And because I didn't think I'd get permission to play Guided by Voices, so I thought, hell, let's do the next best thing. Let's get songs from bands that sound like them that I already have permission for, and many of these songs I have already played in the past. So sit back, enjoy, and now here is the first part of my conversation with John Sellers. Okay, so I'm here with John Sellers, the author of Perfect From Now On, How Indie Rock Saved My Life. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming to San Francisco, all the way from Brooklyn, just for this interview.
Yes, that is true. That's exactly why I'm here.
He did not come here just for this interview, but once I found out that he was coming, I had to have a conversation with him. So we're in a bar in North Beach, and we're having a couple beers, and first question I'd like to ask is, how did you come up, actually it's a two-parter, how did you come up with the book concept, and how difficult was the idea to sell to a publisher?
That's a good question. Good two-part question.
I've got a three and four and five-parter later on.
I want those. Those are a little bit... it's more my style. The idea was completely easy to come up with because it all was based on just, like, my obsessions with music, certain bands, and it happened really when, in 2004, when Guided by Voices... My favorite band. I'm completely,
and mine too, by the way.
Completely obsessed with the band, and that was like the beginning of like the real, like I would say like the pinnacle of my obsession was when they announced that they were going to break up, and I knew that I thought that somebody else would write a book exactly the same as mine, but I wanted to get there first, or I wanted to do it better, and so I just was like, okay, well, how am I going to do this? And so I started writing about, you know, Guided by Voices. But then once I started writing about them, I started thinking about, well, you know, like I used to be really obsessed with Pavement in a way that's very similar to how I'm obsessed with Guided by Voices. And at the same time, I was like, I used to be obsessed with Van Halen in like this, in the same way that I am obsessed with Pavement. So. And that was like 10 years before that, or 20 right. years before. So I just was like, you know, I might as well write a book where...
You kind of trace your musical history.
Yeah, and all my geekiness and all of my obsessions over the years, starting from like, you know, early 1980s going until the present time. Now, how hard was it to sell that to a publisher? It was pretty hard to convince... certain publishers that it was a worthwhile topic, just because, first of all, indie rock is not like, you know, if you write a book about how you're obsessed with, you know, I mean, even Elvis Costello would be somebody that's a little bit more mainstream, where you could probably sell that. But like, you're talking about bands that, you know, I mean, very few people know, in the scheme of things, like, very few people know who Guided by Voices is. So it is hard, but I got a couple of publishers interested, and I got a little lucky, but then also, like...
And you did a lap dance, right?
And I scored some lap dances for the editor that bought it, yes.
Or your agent had to do it.
Yes.
You didn't actually have to do
it. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Awesome. Hey, you were just on a book tour for, what, 4 months? I mean, I think it started roughly March.
Yeah, it was like a stop and start type of thing. But yeah, it started the early part of March, and I just did my last... reading in Chicago like about a week ago.
That's totally awesome that you kind of mostly crisscrossed the country, or did it stay like East Coast?
Yeah,
Midwest.
I did everywhere. I went.
I know you didn't come here.
I didn't come to San Francisco just because I wanted to. If the only way to do San Francisco or like LA for that matter is to like do it right when the book comes out, and I couldn't schedule it where I could do it within the first like 6 weeks that the book was on sale. So I'm gonna come here for sure with the paperback.
Awesome.
But which will come out next March.
I'll be standing in line, definitely.
But yeah, I've been everywhere, man.
One line out takes the edge off.
We're not.
okay, this is a three-parter.
I love it.
How did the book tour come about is the first question. Two, how successful was it? I mean, did you think it was a success? And number three, and this is the one that I most want to know, how the hell did you pick what to read? Because there are so many passages in this book that are laugh out loud funny. Even on the second reading, the second time that I read the book, how did you pick what to read? And how did you, was it the same for every stop? Or did you try to gauge the audience? Or how did this all come about?
My thing was, like, I wanted to read from the beginning, the early part of the book, because that sort of just sets up a lot of things. What I do with the readings, so I generally have read from either chapter one or chapter two. I usually talk about how I grew up with my dad, who was like a Dylan fanatic, and how I just felt oppressed by that, and then, you know, how the first chapter is about that, and how I realized that I've sort of become my dad in a way because of the, you know, my Guided by Voices
obsession. I got news for you. We all become our parents.
I know. That sucks.
And in more ways than one.
I know. It's not really... I mean, it's just ridiculous that I came up to that conclusion. But, and then what I do also on top of it is do footnote-a-rama.
Love it.
So
explain the footnotes to the listeners.
Yeah, so my book has a lot of footnotes. And the main reason for that is, first of all, I'm a total nerd. And I feel like footnotes add to the obsessional quality of, like...
They also make it look academic.
Well, there's that. I'm not an academic, but yeah, no, it's great that you think that, because, you know, I want to be viewed as smart as hell, even though I'm dumb as hell. Yeah, I just feel like when you're talking about music, you go off on tangents, or when you think about it, you're just like, you know, I really love this band. Oh, but that reminds me of something else. And so a lot of the footnotes are just on that level. And then there was also the level of, like, I was talking about Guided by Voices a lot, and I didn't want to bog down the narrative for people who really know a lot about Guided by Voices, explaining them. So I kind of explained the band in the footnotes. So that it has, like, two different purposes. So, like, when I'm reading, I'll like ask people in the audience to shout out a number, and there's 178 footnotes in the book, and so they'll just shout out like 1 through 178, and I'll read whatever it is, but without the context.
Heaven forbid they shout out the number that is that open letter to the guy from
My Bloody Valentine.
My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah, that
that went up pages.
Somebody actually did that at my Chicago reading, and I said that I wasn't going to read that one, but I will give them a free copy of the book just for saying it. So nice. I gave out a free copy of the book for that one.
Nice.
But I won't do that again, so don't.
If so you no go to giveaways reading, on this show.
No giveaways for the next one. That was a spur of the moment thing.
Oh, that's funny. So so how does a book tour happen? Like, okay, so you're signed with Simon & Schuster.
Yeah.
By the way, your contract stipulated 75,000 words. You came up with, I think, 74,837 or something.
75,834. It was just above it.
Oh, it was just above. Okay.
Well, wait. No, what? I might be wrong about that.
No. It was under.
It's under.
You're right. You said so sue me.
We'll do that one again.
You said so sue me. No, that's okay.
That's right. I said so sue me.
Does that include the footnotes? That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, actually, sadly, a third of the book is footnotes. So we're talking...
Not sadly. Actually, the footnotes are pretty fun. If you can remember where you were when you started, because I got to tell my listeners that the footnotes go on sometimes pages and pages, like this open letter to My Bloody Valentine.
There's a Joy Division footnote that goes on
You were going to talk about them in the next chapter, and you said, fuck it. Let's just do it in...
That's 10 pages. Yeah. That one I couldn't resist, because, like, I love Joy Division so much that, you know, I couldn't just write, like, an aside about Joy Division. I had to, like, pretty much make them a chapter, but I couldn't figure out how to make them a chapter based on the whole structure. So, and I was talking about them a lot before I actually introduced them, so I was just like, fuck it, I'll just do a footnote, 10-page footnote.
So how was it successful, your book tour? You think it was a success? I mean, you got a good draw every city you went to?
Definitely. It was
reaction.
Like, you know, every time I did a reading, I was, like, nervous as hell. But, you know, my critical point for failure was 20, and I never went under that. And my point for success was, like, 50, and I went over that, like, half the time.
Nice.
So it was like, it was good. It wasn't like, you know, I'm not Chuck Klosterman, so I'm not going to like, you know, bring 300 people in or whatever. But like the people who came out were like really into it. I had a really good time. Like, you know, I answered questions, but it was more like a discussion. You know, I don't want people to think that I'm like an expert about music. I'm more just like a really big fan of music. And so the people that have come to the readings are pretty big fans of their own bands, and so they ask me questions about the bands that they like. I try to like, you know, hopefully they'll talk about, you know, I'll know the band in question. Sometimes it doesn't happen that way, where I'm like, I don't know that much about Fugazi. Just for one reason or another, never got into them.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. And so, like, you know, I had to answer a question about some guy who, what do you think about Fugazi? And I
was like, Ian McKay of Fugazi? Like, huh?
Yeah. But the thing is, like, totally respect him. Don't know them.
Right.
You know?
Magnetic Health Factory, cool to sad. Yesterday, quickly turned away.
So, back with John Sellers, the author of Perfect From Now On, How Indie Rock Saved My Life. John, the book culminates pretty much with your GBV obsession and where it led you. But for the first half plus, you describe your initiation into the indie rock world in terms of how you sort of got to know bands outside of the mainstream. Can you describe that initiation process in 25 words or less?
25 words or less.
It doesn't have to be 25 words.
I'm going to try to do this in 20. I'm pretty good with words. So
okay, I'll count here.
Well, at least Scrabble words. Used to like Journey. Moved on to U2 and INXS. A girl got me into New Order because I loved her.
23. GBV rules.
No. Two words. It happened.
It's almost like a haiku.
It's the lamest haiku ever.
I knew that was kind of a trick question, but
yeah, that's hard. That's a tough one.
I'm definitely going to be providing links to your blog, your official site, to Amazon.com, where people can buy this book. Because I'm telling you, this book is amazing for anybody who is obsessive about indie rock, as John and I are. Especially if you're obsessive about GBV, and you may not be, but there's so much more than Guided by Voices in that book. It's incredible.
Wow, that's awesome for you to say that.
So, a brief history of Guided by Voices for those who don't know. You know, fourth grade school teacher, records on weekends and at nights in a basement with his friends, releasing albums that only they and their friends have ever heard. Fast forward to, I think it was 1993, at the CMJ Music Festival in New York, they get invited to play a stage. The Beastie Boys are there, the Sonic Youth is there, everybody's into them. They just blow away the industry types, and they keep rocking and start churning out many more albums until 2004 was their last one.
Yeah.
Half Smiles, yeah. Okay, so that's brief history. So John, what does the music and even the mythology, because there's a ton of mythology surrounding them from Dayton, Ohio, okay? Backwater. Good rock band's not supposed to come from that. 36-year-old, fourth grade school teacher. Not supposed to happen. You know, lo-fi recording, low production quality. Not supposed to happen. Does the mythology and the music mean as much to you now and is it still as powerful now as when you wrote the book?
I think the mythology is like one of the more important things about the band. Besides, I mean, the music, undeniably amazing. So that I mean, obviously that's got to be the big thing. But you add on all this other stuff, and to me, it's like, you know, so much more appealing because you have this guy who's pretty much like, when I discovered them, I discovered them in 2002, way too late, way after their heyday. It's my fault. I just sort of, I don't know. I mean, I do this because I get obsessed about bands and I just ignore certain things. So I didn't really discover them until 2002. And when I found out about all this other stuff, after I knew about the music, it just like was amazing. Like, this guy was a school teacher, obscure as hell, all through the 80s. He was 34, 35, or 36 when he really became like well known in the indie rock community. And at the time that I was discovering it, I was like pretty much around, I was 32, and
kind of close to the same age.
Yeah, and it was just like, yeah, I mean, I can totally see how a guy can like go through his entire 20s doing something that he really loves, but no one pays attention to it, especially a guy from the Midwest. I'm from Michigan. And
with no discernible Michigan accent, by the way.
I
have family from Michigan. And
I know. I try to get over it, but I have lived in New York for 15 years, and I still have my stupid accent. But I don't know.
Not noticeable to me, because I would tell you.
Okay, good. And my mom's a school teacher as well, and like, so when I heard about all this stuff, like that, the backstory of the band, I was just like, okay, well, this is like people that I sort of identify with in a way. way. And, you know, then the other thing is you see them live and, you know, they don't wear makeup, they don't, like, strike poses or whatever.
It's t-shirts, jeans, and Gibson guitars.
And basically drinking beer and rocking out. And they're not embarrassed about it. They're not really, you know, they're not hipsters. They're just like normal dudes who write great songs. And to me, like, a guy who likes, I used to really love Van Halen, but then I also got into the Smiths and Morrissey and like Interpol, and it's sort of like the exact middle of that in a way. It's like, you know, they're not stupid and they're not pretentious. It's like the perfect middle ground.
They just rock.
And they just rock and they're just cool about it.
Nice. So you've actually done what I've always wanted to do, but I've never had either the resources, i.e. your friend Corey, who knew Matt Davis, who is one of Robert Pollard's Inner Circle members.
Yes.
And I've also never had the balls to do it. And that is, you've got to meet your hero. What was it like? Did he amaze, disappoint, somewhere in between? I mean, I've read the book twice. I know what you've said in the book. I just want you to tell the listeners how, I mean, for anybody out there who has idolized a particular musician or artist or actor or politician, what's it like to finally meet your hero?
I would say, in general, it's probably not a good idea to do it. But in this particular case, like, Pollard is very similar to me and a lot of his fans, only, like, maybe 10 years older, a little bit more than that.
And much more well-known than I am.
Much more well-known and famous. But the thing about him as a guy is that he likes to do a lot of the same stuff that I like to do. He likes to watch sports. He likes to rock out to music. And he likes to drink beer and have fun. The fact that he's like a musical genius is like the unique thing about him. But he's like a normal guy who likes to have a good time. And so meeting him, I was like really nervous when I went into it because I didn't want to make a fool out of myself by saying like, oh, remember that one song you did in 1994?
That was awesome,
the Chris Farley thing. And like, you know, I didn't want to be that guy because he's got a lot of those guys. And so I just basically shut the hell up.
This is where you were.
switching gears just a slight tad bit, we'll get back to GBB, I think, later on. Maybe, maybe not. A lot of the bands and the music that you write about are fairly well known in your book, at least in, you know, quote unquote alternative or indie circles like Nirvana, Radiohead, Smashing Pumpkins, U2.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays you might not call that indie rock.
I think we're going to call it classic rock now.
Classic rock. That scares me. When I was when I was listening to like 1984 as classic rock, you know, a song from The Jump or something, Panama, I was like, no. I was in high school. That's not classic rock.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, AC/DC was classic rock. But but they're all, you know, most of them started or at least graduated to major labels. I want to know how familiar are you, John Sellers, with like non-RIAA bands, or bands way, way far away from the indie mainstream? And the second part of the question, what in your mind constitutes indie music?
I mean, that's a completely valid question. And, you know, I call the book, you know, the subtitle is How Indie Rock Saved My Life. But, you know, for me, like, I sort of stopped listening. Like, when I got into the bands that I'm really into, they were, well, besides Guided by Voices, which I got in too late, but they were all indie rock. And now, like, U2, I didn't like them after maybe, like, 1987 or whatever, or 88. Like, they're way more considered, like, the established band, the mainstream band. But when I first got into them, they were, like, out there. Like, they weren't, they, like, that was the era of, like, you know,
Cyndi Lauper
and Madonna and stuff. And, like, you heard, like, Joshua Tree, like, some of those songs on the radio, and, like, it was, like, totally different. Completely different.
Although they exploded with that album.
That was their big album. That's, but, like, Nirvana, yeah, like, definitely they were on a major label, but still, they were completely different than any band that was around at the time. And Radiohead has always been on a major label, as far as I know. And
they don't necessarily court mainstream success.
Yeah. So that, to me, like, the term indie rock is sort of like a case by case basis, because, you know, you have bands like, you know, The Smiths and, you know, Joy Division, Built to Spill in their early years. They're definitely like indie bands, you know, like they're bands that sound indie. That you don't play them on the radio. You wouldn't hear them if you didn't seek them out in some way or another. And I guess that would be the definition of indie rock for me, is just like you can't hear them through normal channels, meaning like radio, MTV. MTV, you never hear anything anymore,
MTV,
I guess.
MTV is irrelevant.
But, you know, a band, even bands on major labels, who you do hear on the radio, I feel like can sometimes be thrown in the indie rock, you know, catch-all, just because, well, you have, like, Weezer and their first album. It just was, like, it wasn't indie rock, but it was, like, different.
It
was different rock, I guess. Maybe that's what I mean. Different rock.
So let's talk about your...
Oh, but and on top, the other question on that one was, how familiar am I with bands that aren't really...
Totally off, that are non-RIAA, they're unsigned, or...
I wish that I was more... I wish I sought out more bands, but... I'm now relying on people to introduce me to bands.
I'll send you an email with a list of my favorites.
That's what I want.
That you've never heard of.
There's a lot
that
of bands
I played on my show
that I've never heard of.
That I played on my mixtapes that I release with somewhat regularity.
I want it all.
You're gonna get it.
Awesome.
Okay, so let's explain briefly your it's not an obsession, your penchant for making lists.
I like lists.
Lists of, well, I bookmarked some of these pages here in the book. For example, obviously, my top 10 favorite albums. Okay,
that's the easy one.
That's the 8 dingers. In other words, a dinger, according to John Sellers, is an album that has no bad songs whatsoever. And I would have to, I've heard probably 4 or 6 of these 8, and I would have to agree. The top five most disappointing albums.
Yeah.
The top nine worst names of alternative bands I used to sort of like. That's a good one. So I'd like to collaborate on a few lists that are not mentioned
in
the book. Let's start a new list.
Let's do it.
Ad hoc here. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the best indie debut albums. I have a few listed.
The best indie debut albums. No, well, number one has to be Senate and Enchanted by Pavement.
That's on my list.
I think that's number one. There's no question. I mean, you come up with one that's better than that, and I'll give you...
I actually have two that's okay. better than that, but...
What are your two that are better than that?
R.E.M.'s Murmur?
No. No.
Well, see, okay, your New Order and Joy Division was my R.E.M.
Okay.
In college.
All right. Well, no, I love R.E.M.
Yeah.
Well, early R.E.M. In fact, but the thing is, I just heard Shiny Happy People at a bar right before I came here.
And it disgusted you.
That song sucks so bad, I want to kill it. I want to kill everyone involved with that song. Fuck.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
So, like, that to me, like, kind of ruins them. But, yeah
Murmur
is amazing.
Murmur is amazing. And the only other one that I would put above Slanted and Enchanted is Stone Roses.
Their first Stone Roses album.
Eponymous, the self-entitled.
That's a great album. I would say that Slanted and Enchanted is better. But it's, I can't really fight you on that one. It's, you know, it's 1-2.
I actually heard about the Stone Roses album while I was in the apartment that Scott Canberg lived in. I was at a party at his...
You mean Scott Canberg?
Canberg, whatever.
No, it's Canberg.
It's Canberg, right? I know.
I used to call him that.
Yeah, I was...
No, okay, well, the number... there's a big one that we're missing out on here, which is, you know, obviously the Smiths' first album.
I was never really into the Smiths, but that's valid, because you go on at large about them.
Wow. I mean, yeah.
I would put The Strokes, Is This It?
That's a good indie album.
I mean, I don't know if we're limiting ourselves to 5 or 8 or 10.
I think we need to do 7.
Okay, so we've done Murmur, Stone Roses, Pavement, Strokes, Smiths. That's 5.
Oh, there's so many more than this.
Debut albums. There's one glaring omission that I have to call you on the carpet for.
What's that?
Because they also don't appear in one of your last appendices.
Oh my god, what is it?
The 173 bands that I have to list.
Yeah, because I never...
Otherwise you're gonna get bad email.
What was that one?
Pearl Jam's 10.
Oh.
Did you like them at all?
No.
You didn't like them?
I don't like Pearl Jam.
Okay. I don't consider
them at all indie. And I never have.
Really?
They
kind of came out of nowhere.
They did, and they, you know, they definitely have certain things about them that are like indie rock.
I mean, they were released on Epic or Sony, so they were never like...
I've never really considered them. I mean, like, I guess that's just maybe more of a personal thing.
Because you have some of that like early '90s Seattle grunge. You have you list Soundgarden.
I don't want to feel like a dick, because like here's the thing, like they took Robert Pollard on their last tour. They played 2 shows with him in the Midwest, and he's been a huge supporter of them. He's been a huge supporter of some other indie rock bands. So I'm not saying that he himself is not an indie guy. I just feel like the band overall, like, and the way they've been marketed to people, especially early on, that album, the first album, 10, was a huge, like, you know... That was basically the equivalent of Nevermind, but, you know, Nirvana had been around, and so they had put out Bleach.
I think they were released within, like, 6 months of each
other. Exactly, but they were released the same way, which is, like, a very major label way. They flooded MTV with it.
Right.
They flooded the radio with it. But Nirvana gets bonus points for having been obscure for a while and been on Sub Pop, whereas, like, Pearl Jam started out in that way. And
interestingly,
they've actually gotten more indie rock in a way, at least in their midterm period.
Because they went to an indie label now. They're on, the J label or something.
That's right. They're on the J label. Yeah.
But interestingly enough, you do list Mother Love Bone in one of those 173 bands.
Dude.
Two of the members of which were,
But they were obscure, and they, you know...
All right. Well, that's a further definition of indie that I think the listeners would like to hear.
Chinese baby speaking. backwards. My people in the cabin keep an eye on loggers preparing for battle.
Okay, so, Perfect From Now On, How Indie Rock Saved My Life. For those who don't know, Perfect From Now On is the title of a seminal Built to Spill album. It's one of my top 10 Desert Island discs, definitely. If I only had 10 to live for the rest of my life, Perfect From Now On would be right there with albums like OK Computer and Airplane Over the Sea from Neutromilk Hotel, and throw a few GBVs in there and a couple of others that I've discovered recently. But pick another title for your book, one that's GBV specific. In here you say that at one point the working title was Gold Sounds, which is a track from Pavement's album Crooked Rain.
Right.
If you had to pick a GBV specific title, what would it be? I've got three suggestions. And you can shoot them down.
I had
throw out your other ones.
I had a long, long list of GBV titles that I should call this book.
What about Smothered in Hugs?
Smothered in Hugs was like a big one. That is the final chapter. Is the title of the final chapter of the book. In fact, if you look through, there's six GBV titles,
yeah.
Songs, and they are used as chapter titles. And I was going to use, give me your other two, and I'll tell you the one that I think should have been the actual title of the
book. Between the Devil and My Toes?
that's pretty good.
their first album... Oh, except for their Forever Since Breakfast is the other one that's listed right here. You can look at it right there.
Devil Between My Toes is like, yeah, I mean, that's like their first album. Come on. That's
the R.E.M.-ish sounding.
Yeah, yeah. But, it sounds exactly like them. The one that I feel like probably most would sum up what the book's theme about is Sad If I Lost It, which is one of my favorite GBV songs from Mag Earwig, and it's just, I'll wear my maroon blazer all the time. It's just like,
he lost here,
it's a very poignant song.
Somebody stole.
Yeah, it's like, it just, that song rules.
It does rule.
And so I wouldn't have chosen a title by GBV that didn't rule. So I had like 1,000 songs to choose from. It was really hard to narrow it down. So I had to go with a band that I didn't talk about very much.
I know that you, in one of your footnoteramas, you mentioned how you kind of binged on Perfect From Now On, the Built to Spill album, on one weekend, and said, okay, this is the title. But you really don't talk about Built to Spill at all.
No, not too much, and I feel bad about it.
It's an amazing. That's an amazing band. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, they're,
like I said, this is my Desert Island disc right here.
For me, it was like, okay, well, I have a lot of things to say about Pavement because they were a band that I discovered very early on in their history, and the band that had to come after them was Guided by Voices because that was a lot of the narrative. And so I have a lot of things leading up to my Pavement obsession, and then basically Pavement obsession sets up my Guided by Voices stuff. So to me, like Built to Spill, like there was no real place for to talk about them other than in like an aside, because I never loved them the way that I loved Pavement. But I started listening to them around the same time, or maybe a little bit after, but like there just wasn't enough for me to like turn them into a chapter. And then I was like, okay, well, I need to write a really long footnote about them or something, you know, something where I do the band justice. But then I was like, you know, there's no way to do them justice in a footnote. They're one of my favorite bands of all time. I'm taking the title of the book from them. I think maybe that's enough of a tribute.
That's a cause to write a different book about indie rock.
And I think my next book will actually be, the title will be Sad If I Lost It, and I'll write all about Built to Spill.
Classic. Nice. So what are you working on next? Are you currently working on something?
I have another book in the works, yes. I'm also doing, right now I'm writing an appendix or an epilogue to the hardcover for the paperback, which is coming out next March.
Cool.
And it's actually, a lot of it's about Built to Spill.
Nice.
Because I have gotten a lot of emails from people who are huge Built to Spill fans. And they're like, you know, I bought this book because I like Built to Spill, and then we don't talk about them. It's a little misleading. So, like, I want to apologize to all those people, and I also want to show them that, you know, I am a fan of theirs. And, you know, hopefully people don't take it that seriously. Like, you know, if I bought a book called Perfect From Now On and it didn't talk about Built to Spill, I would hate that guy. But
if you bought a book called Nevermind and it talked about Don McLean's American Pie.
Yeah. That's totally different. Fuck that guy. Fuck that writer.
Exactly.
You know? Like, that's the worst song ever.
Oh, I am totally in agreement. That's so number one on your list.
Can I say one thing about San Francisco?
Sure.
I mean, this is a San Francisco show. I just want to say, walking around North Beach a little bit, went to City Lights Bookstore, which is a great store. But when I was in there, they played 3 Bob Dylan songs. I walked outside and walked by this cafe. Over the fucking loudspeakers, there was a Bob Dylan song playing. What's up with that? That was 45 years ago. Get over it.
For people who haven't read Perfect From Now On, the very first line in the book, the very first word or sentence in the first chapter is, I hate Bob Dylan. That should tell you everything you need to know.
I mean, I'm not saying that Bob Dylan's not worthy of the acclaim and all that stuff. He's got some great songs. But, you know, like, it's time to maybe move on.
Check out the book. I am going to post links to the Amazon site, to John's site, to his blog on the show notes when I release this episode. So you can check out the book. And I highly, highly recommend it. I've read it twice. It's amazing stuff. It's laugh out loud funny. I can't wait to read it a third time, actually. My wife rolls her eyes when she looks at me with this book, but...
You're an idiot. I don't know what you're doing.
Actually, if I'm an idiot, you're an idiot, because I am an indie rock obsessive like you, and that's kind of how I thought this book really connected with me. We both grew up in smaller towns, you in the Midwest, me in the Central Valley of California. But replace, you know, Music Land for Sam Goody or any kind of number of circumstances, right. And we lived the same life, basically. Hmm. You're a couple of months younger than I am, I think.
That's cool.
I was born in October 69. You were mid-70s.
1970.
Yeah, so we lived the same life, sort of. And we adopted the same band as our favorite, so... Any closing remarks, John?
Sorry about the Bob Dylan rant.
Don't apologize.
The thing is, I respect him. Thing is, if you read the first chapter, you'll understand why I don't like him.
And why he became like his father.
Yeah. And on top of it, you know, Bob Dylan just kind of sucks. I'm an ass.
On that note, we're going to play the last song of this episode. See you guys later. Take care.
Mission 5. I know you know.
I see everyone and no one at all. Just when it starts, it's done. Like summer turns into fall. Sometimes it's the little things.
This has been a joint production of Indie Music Project and Insomnia Radio, killing your FM around the world. Make sure to check out our site at sf.insomniaradio.net. And thanks for listening, gang. We'll see you next time.